A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Here's the thing. A few weeks ago, I'm holding my tefillin, and the black paint on the boxes has chipped. Which happens, it's leather. You wear it every day, it rubs against things. And I think to myself, can I just grab a Sharpie and touch this up? Seems obvious, right? It's black, it's permanent. So I Google it. And within about 30 seconds, I've fallen through a trapdoor into a world of halachic ink chemistry. Rabbinic rulings about synthetic dyes, and online forums where people are debating the molecular structure of gallantic acid.
The debates get wonderfully technical. It's one of those things where the surface question is so simple, and the answer is basically a 2,000-year-old material science debate that's still ongoing. I love this stuff. It's exactly the kind of niche where ancient material science crashes into modern chemical engineering, and millions of dollars of commerce hang in the balance.
And let me tell you, I have since been to that store. It looks like a cross between an art supply shop and a medieval apothecary.
And the first thing to understand is that we're really talking about three completely different categories of ink. There's the ink used for actually writing sacred texts. Torah scrolls, mezuzah scrolls, the parchment scrolls inside tefillin. That's called Dio. Then there's the black paint used on the tefillin boxes themselves, the Batim. And then there's the dye for the leather straps, the retsuo.
The core principle behind Dio.
It has to be permanent in a very specific way. The ink must bond with the parchment, it cannot be erasable by water, and it has to be made from particular ingredients. So let's start with the big one, the writing ink. What makes an ink kosher for sacred writing? The foundational requirement comes from the Talmud, Tractate Shabbat 23a, which specifies four ingredients. You need gallnut juice, that's a fatsim, gum arabic, which is comer, copper sulfate, or cancantum, and water, that's the recipe. And the reason this matters is that Jewish law requires the ink to be kayamut, permanent.
That's one of those words that sounds like you're casting a spell.
You can't just use any black pigment. The Talmudic rabbis may not have understood the chemistry, but they knew empirically that ink without copper sulfate didn't last.
They stumbled onto a remarkably stable formulation through trial and error.
When you crush them and soak them in water, you get a tannin-rich solution. Then you add iron sulfate, which in the ancient world came from copper sulfate, concantum, that naturally contained iron impurities. The tannins react with the iron to form a black pigment that chemically bonds with the collagen in the parchment. It's not sitting on top of the surface like a modern ballpoint pen. It's actually become part of the material.
It's less like painting and more like staining. A chemical reaction at the molecular level.
That's exactly what it is. And that reaction creates ferrogallate complexes, iron tannin compounds, that are intensely black and incredibly stable. The gum arabic serves as a binder and a suspension agent, keeping the pigment particles evenly distributed in the liquid, so the scribe gets consistent flow from the quill. It's the same basic chemistry that was used for the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Magna Carta, the U, for about 1500 years. This was the standard writing ink for anything that mattered.
Which raises the obvious question. If iron gall ink was the standard for everything important in the Western world, why did Jewish scribal practice specifically settle on this formulation?
A big one. Iron gall ink is acidic. Over centuries, it literally eats through the parchment. That's why so many medieval manuscripts have holes where the letters used to be. The ink has corroded the page. The Talmud doesn't say, use iron gall. It specifies the ingredients by their ancient names. But what's fascinating is that there was actually a major debate in the medieval period about whether carbon-based ink was acceptable.
What does a modern scribe actually use? What's in the bottle in 2026?
The Dead Sea Scrolls used carbon-based ink, and it's actually pH neutral, unlike iron gall ink, which is acidic. But the rabbinic consensus eventually came down on the side of iron gall, largely because of the permanence requirement. Carbon ink sits on the surface and can be scraped off. Iron gall ink penetrates the parchment fibers. The manufacturing process is surprisingly involved. They burn olive oil or other vegetable oils in a controlled chamber and collect the soot, then grind it to a specific particle size, under 10 microns. In Hillshot Tefillin, Chapter 1, Law 4, he codifies the recipe. And he's very specific. If the ink can be erased, the scroll is invalid. The Sefer Hachinach in the 13th century added that the ink must not be removable with water. So you can see the legal reasoning evolving. Permanence is the core value, and iron gall delivers permanence in a way that carbon ink doesn't. Although, ironically, iron gall ink's acidity means it eventually destroys the very parchment it's preserving. Medieval manuscripts written with iron gall ink often have holes where the ink literally ate through the page.
You've got this tension. The ink that best satisfies the legal requirement for permanence is also the ink that's slowly destroying the document. That feels like a metaphor for something.
The universe has a sense of humor. And this brings us to the 19th century crisis, which is where the story gets really interesting. Industrial chemistry arrives, and suddenly you have synthetic aniline dyes, coal tar derivatives that produce a deep, uniform black. They're cheaper, they're consistent, they don't eat through parchment. Scribes start using them.
Although I imagine the Talmudic scribe wasn't buying his ink from a website with a kosher certification logo.
The reasoning was that the Talmud specified these ingredients, and synthetic dyes are not the same thing even if they produce the same color. But it's not certifying that the ink is kosher to eat, which is what a heksher normally means. It's certifying that the ink meets halachic standards for scribal use. The certifiers are testing for three things: no synthetic resins, carbon source is from a permitted oil, and no animal-derived ingredients.
Wait, animal-derived?
Others insist that the ink should be made by hand, or at least that certain steps in the process should be done manually. The Israeli chief rabbinate's Soferut department issued a ruling in 2024 requiring all Torah scrolls written after 2025 to use ink with a minimum 3% iron content to ensure permanence.
The market settled on a plant-based binder, partly for halachic simplicity.
And it's worth noting that gum arabic is also just a better binder for this application. It's more flexible when dry, it doesn't become brittle and crack, and it's water-soluble during writing, but water-resistant once cured. They absolutely did. And that ruling was prompted by a case in Binai Brak where a sofer had been using non-certified ink. It looked right, it wrote right, but chemical analysis showed it didn't have the proper iron gall composition.
Which brings us to the 19th century shift, and the first major controversy in modern ink history.
The invention of aniline dyes and synthetic pigments in the 1800s created a fork in the road. Suddenly, you could buy commercial India ink, carbon black suspended in shellac, that was cheap, consistent, and readily available. Some Jewish communities, especially in more isolated areas, started using it for Torah scrolls, and that triggered a halachic crisis.
Because shellac isn't tree sap in the traditional sense.
If the ink doesn't meet the standard, the writing itself is considered defective regardless of how perfect the letter forms are, so the chemistry matters at the level of religious obligation. That's what makes this more than just a historical curiosity. His reasoning, the Talmud specifies tree sap, and shellac is an insect secretion, not a plant product. It fails on both counts, wrong source organism, and it's not even sap, it's a processed resin.
The biological origin of the binder becomes a make-or-break issue.
The Dead Sea Scrolls survived partly because they used carbon ink, but medieval Torah scrolls, many of them have significant degradation. Modern sofer ink is a hybrid. It's still iron gall at its core, using gall nuts harvested primarily in Turkey and Greece, where the Aleppo oak produces galls with particularly high tannin content.
That's the story of scroll ink, ancient, stable, and non-negotiable. But tefillin ink, that's where things get weird.
Some manufacturers also add small amounts of carbon black to deepen the color and improve opacity without compromising the iron gall chemistry. And that ambiguity has spawned a spectrum of opinions that ranges from anything goes to the strictest possible standard.
Let's map that spectrum.
In 2022, researchers at Cambridge University Library, led by Dr. Rebecca Stacey, did a systematic chemical analysis of the inks in Geniza fragments. They found a clear progression. The earliest documents, 9th and 10th century, used carbon-based inks. Then around the 10th and 11th century, you see the shift to iron gall. And by the later periods, you see mixed formulations where scribes were clearly experimenting with different recipes.
That's the kind of concrete evidence that turns speculation into science. You can literally watch the transition happen across the centuries in one collection.
It tells you that even in the medieval period, scribes were not blindly following a single recipe. They were adapting, testing, trying to balance performance and longevity. The idea of a frozen, unchanging tradition is a modern fiction. The tradition has always been a conversation.
Which brings us to the part of the prompt that I think most people listening will actually find immediately useful. The tefillin boxes and straps.
Which creates a practical problem. DO is formulated to bond with parchment, not with painted leather boxes or flexible leather straps. If you paint gum arabic-based ink onto a tefillin box, it might not adhere well. The tefillin touch-up question is controversial. The Shulchan Aruch, Orach Shahim 32, Law 46, says the boxes must be black. The straps, Orach Shahim 33, Law 3, also must be black.
The market invented a compromise.
His reasoning was that the requirement is for the boxes to be black, and a permanent marker makes them black. It's a functionalist position. Rav Obadiah Yosef, in Yabia Omer, took a stricter view. He required specifically formulated paint or dye that was manufactured with the intention of being used for sacred purposes. It's marketed as halachically acceptable, but not mehudar, not the most beautified option. The strictest communities won't use it, but many others do.
The debate hinges on whether acrylic counts as a valid binder.
If your tefillin boxes aren't properly black, there are opinions that the mitzvah isn't fulfilled. You could be putting on tefillin every day and not getting credit for it, so to speak. And replacement tefillin boxes, batim, run anywhere from $200 to $500 for a basic set, up to several thousand for higher quality ones.
The $5 Sharpie is gambling with a $500 ritual object.
That's exactly how most rabbis frame it. Why take the risk? The certified markers are maybe $12 to $15. They're manufactured under rabbinic supervision, and the ink formulation is verified to meet the relevant standards. Companies like Lerman's and Sofer Supplies sell what are essentially halachic Sharpies. They look like regular permanent markers, but the ink inside is a specific formulation, usually acrylic, based with certification that it bonds permanently to leather and won't flake off. Most poskim say Sharpies are invalid for tefillin touch-ups for both reasons. They're not permanent in the halachic sense, and they use dye rather than pigment.
I can't just grab the Sharpie from my desk drawer.
On leather, especially the treated leather of tefillin boxes, they can sit on the surface and eventually flake off. The certified products use acrylic-based formulations that penetrate the leather more effectively and remain flexible as the leather expands and contracts with temperature and humidity.
The irony being that in a blind test, they'd perform identically.
And there's a subset of markers that are specifically labeled Loshem Kedusha Tefillin, meaning they were manufactured with the explicit intention of being used for this sacred purpose. A Torah scroll written with Sharpie ink would be possible, invalid, even if it looked perfect on day one.
Let's walk through what you'd actually see if you walked into a Sofer Supply store in Jerusalem in 2026. Paint me the shelves.
For Torah scrolls and mezuzot, the scribe has to declare before writing that this is for the sake of the mitzvah. For tefillin boxes, there's a debate about whether the black paint needs to be applied lishma. The stricter opinions say yes, which is why you'll find tefillin paint that comes with a little declaration on the label, manufactured Loshem Kedushat Tefillin. That one bottle can write an entire Torah scroll, 304,805 letters. The ink is surprisingly thin, almost like water, because it needs to flow through a quill without clogging.
It's black, but not the deepest black you've ever seen.
Carbon black has a slightly warm undertone compared to synthetic blacks. It's a very specific shade. Next section, Tefillin Box Ink. 50 milliliter bottles, $15 to $25, labeled for batim only. The traditional method for dyeing tefillin straps is lamp black mixed with oil. Lamp black is basically pure carbon soot. You hold a plate over an oil flame and collect the black residue. Mix it with linseed oil or olive oil, and you get a paste that's worked into the leather. It's messy, it takes forever to dry, and it rubs off on your clothes if you're not careful.
Then the markers.
Kosher markers, $8 to $12 each, black only. You'll never find a blue or red kosher marker because there's no application for it. The Sharpie Tefillin Controversy. Someone posted a TikTok video showing themselves touching up their tefillin straps with a Sharpie. It went viral in the Orthodox corner of the internet. Within 48 hours, you had a wave of rabbinic responses. Some saying it's fine, some saying it's absolutely not fine, some saying it's fine for the straps but not the boxes, some saying the opposite. It was a perfect microcosm of how social media forces halachic questions into public view in real time. There are eraser solutions for correcting mistakes, a mixture of water and a mild acid that can lift fresh ink from parchment without damaging it, and there are various additives that Sofrim mix into their ink to adjust flow and drying time.
Some Sofrim don't buy ink at all.
It's a poetic standard, but it's been interpreted to mean a deep, matte black that comes from carbon pigment specifically. Sharpies use synthetic dyes that have a slightly different sheen. More importantly, Sharpie ink on leather straps tends to look purple-black rather than true black, and it fades to a brownish color over time. The certified strap dyes are formulated to maintain a true black on leather specifically.
It's a color fastness issue dressed up in legal language. The Sharpie technically works, but it doesn't work well, and over time it fails to meet the standard.
That's the practical reality, and it brings us to the modern Sofer supply store, which is where this whole world becomes tangible. If you walk into a shop in Jerusalem or Bini Brak or Brooklyn, what are you actually seeing on the shelves? The Sofer in Mea Shera making his own ink is doing something that's considered more beautified, but not more valid in the binary sense.
Let's talk economics. What does a working Sofer actually spend on supplies?
It comes in a 100-milliliter bottle, costs about $25, and it's iron gall based with modern pH buffers. It's black, it flows well from a quill, and it meets the requirements of all major halachic authorities. Then there's the premium tier, Diomahedron, which uses a higher concentration of gallnut extract and is typically made in smaller batches. That runs about $40 for the same size bottle. The difference is mostly about color depth and adhesion. Sofrim who do high-end work, like writing a Torah scroll for a major synagogue, will often use the premium ink.
Then you've got the tefillin paint. That's a separate shelf entirely.
Separate product category. Tefillin box paint is typically acrylic-based with halachic certification. Small bottles, maybe $15 each. It's thick, almost like model paint, and you apply it with a small brush. There's also spray-on versions now. I've seen those in some stores, but most Sofrim prefer brush application because you can control the thickness and avoid getting paint into the seams of the boxes.
The spray paint tefillin feels like a step too far, somehow, even if it's technically fine.
There's something viscerally wrong about it. But the strap dye is where you see the most variety. You've got alcohol-based leather dyes in little dropper bottles, lamp black paste in jars, and these felt tip applicators that look like shoe polish daubers but are certified for tefillin use. The prices range from $12 to $30 depending on the brand and the certification level.
The brands themselves are worth noting. Lerman's is probably the biggest name and the Ubez Yakov is another major one. In Israel, you've got Stam 2000 and a company called Dior HaSofer, which literally means the scribe's ink.
There's a fascinating new product that launched in 2025, Dio Digital. It's a QR code tracked ink bottle. You scan the code on the bottle, and it pulls up the batch certification from the rabbinic supervisor, the date of manufacture, the chemical analysis showing iron content and pH levels. About 200 Sofrim in Israel are using it now.
It's a global supply chain. The acacia trees in Sudan don't know they're producing kosher ink for Jewish scribes.
That's created some interesting supply chain issues. There have been periods where gum Arabic was hard to source because of conflicts in Sudan. The ink manufacturers had to stockpile or find alternative sources. It solves a real problem. The B'nai Brak case I mentioned earlier, the 50 invalidated mezuzot, that happened because there was no easy way to verify what was actually in the ink bottle.
Which brings me to a broader question. You mentioned that the standard formulation hasn't changed much in 1500 years, but the manufacturing process has. There's also a whole DIY movement, which I did not expect to find. People making their own ink from raw gallnuts.
The online forums are incredible. Stamforum.com, various Soferet Facebook groups. There are hobbyists who source raw Aleppo oak galls from Turkey, crush them themselves, soak them in rainwater, add their own iron sulfate, and cook the whole thing down to the right consistency.
The scribe's intentionality when writing is what matters, not the factory workers when mixing.
And that's consistent with how other ritual objects work. The parchment has to be processed, lishma. The person treating the hide has to verbally declare that they're doing it for the sake of the mitzvah. But the ink? No such requirement. The risks are significant. If you get the pH wrong, if your ink is too acidic, you can destroy a parchment worth thousands of dollars.
Let's pivot to the practical takeaway. After all this, what should someone actually do if their tefillin needs a touch-up?
You don't want to be experimenting with homemade ink on that kind of material. The dye-based ink will fade and most Postgem deem it invalid. Cost is about $10 and one marker will last you years because you're only touching up small areas.
For the boxes versus the straps.
It's the same impulse that drives people to bake their own sourdough or carve their own furniture. There's something satisfying about controlling the entire process from raw materials to finished product. And if you're in a community that follows the stricter opinions, you might want to have a sofer do the touch-up with actual Dio. But for most people, the kosher marker is the practical solution.
For Torah scroll ink, never substitute. Only use Dio with a hetcher from a recognized authority. The ink is cheap relative to the scroll. A $30 bottle writes an entire Torah. The risk of using invalid ink is that the scroll becomes pasur, requiring costly rewrites of every affected section.
That's not a theoretical risk. Turkish oak gall harvest dropped 30% in 2024 due to drought conditions. That's a big number. It means the raw material is getting scarcer and more expensive. There's a startup in Rehovot. This is fascinating. That's engineering yeast to produce gallantanic acid through fermentation.
The broader lesson here is that ancient material constraints create modern niche markets. This isn't unique to Scribal Ink. Designer gal nuts from a bioreactor. That feels like the logical endpoint of this entire trajectory. 2,000 years of tradition leading to genetically modified yeast making, Talmudic ink. Kosher gelatin is a whole industry built around the question of whether gelatin from non-kosher animals is chemically transformed enough to be considered a new substance. Kosher electronics for Shabbat observance, elevators that stop on every floor, ovens with Sabbath modes, light switches that use indirect mechanisms.
That debate hasn't been formally adjudicated yet, but it's coming.
The 2024 Chief Rabbinate ruling about iron content is interesting in this context because it suggests a willingness to use modern analytical standards.
That's a fascinating economic model. You're paying for compliance, not performance. It's like paying more for a UL-listed electrical component even though the unlisted one is electrically identical, which opens the door to alternative production methods that achieve the same chemical outcome. But there's a limit to how far that logic can go.
For the curious listener who wants to see this world firsthand, if you're in Jerusalem, walk into Katab Stem on Rechov Malkei Yisrael. Ask to see the different inks. Where that line gets drawn is going to depend on economics as much as theology. If Turkish gallnut harvests keep declining, the price of traditional ink will keep rising. At some point, the cost pressure becomes impossible to ignore.
The quills are worth looking at, too. A hand-cut goose feather quill is a beautiful object. The scribe cuts it at a specific angle, usually around 45 degrees, and splits the tip so it holds ink. The skill involved in cutting a good quill is substantial, and a well-cut quill makes the difference between smooth writing and constant frustration.
After all this, I have an open question. Synthetic biology is advancing fast. We can engineer yeast to produce insulin. We can engineer bacteria to produce spider silk. Could we engineer a tree or a microbe to produce the perfect gum arabic substitute, chemically identical to the acacia sap, but produced in a bioreactor? Or a microbe that excretes lamp black quality carbon particles? The halachic implications would be fascinating. Is bioengineered ink natural? If a yeast cell produces gum arabic proteins, is that tree sap in the halachic sense?
That's exactly the kind of question that's going to land on some rabbi's desk in the next decade. The halachic system has categories for natural versus synthetic, but it doesn't have a well-developed category for biologically engineered. If the yeast produces molecules that are chemically identical to acacia gum, is that the same substance or a different substance? The answer probably depends on whether you prioritize chemical composition or biological origin.
Whichever way the Poskim rule, the market will follow. If they say bioengineered gum arabic is valid, someone will start manufacturing it and selling it with a hetcher. If they say it's not, the acacia harvesters in Sudan will have job security for another generation.
The materials and knowledge have changed, but the fundamental project hasn't. It's a living legal system applied to material science.
It all started with me wondering if I could use a Sharpie.
They cost about $12 to $15. Standard Sharpies may be halachically acceptable according to some opinions, particularly if you follow Rav Moshe Feinstein's ruling, but the risk of invalidation is not worth saving $5.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1930s, French botanists studying moss reproduction in Djibouti discovered that a single square meter of desert moss can release over 400 million spores in a single rainy season. Meaning, per square kilometer, moss produces roughly 400 trillion spores, which is approximately the number of stars in 4,000 Milky Way galaxies.
Right. That leaves us with a question for the future, not just about ink, but about how ancient legal systems adapt to technologies their authors couldn't have imagined. For actual scrolls, Torah scrolls, mezuzah scrolls, tefillin scrolls, don't touch them yourself at all. That's not a DIY project.
If a letter in a mezuzah or tefillin scroll is cracked or faded, take it to a qualified sofer. They'll use traditional iron gall ink from a reputable supplier, and they'll know how to apply it so that the repair is halachically valid.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.